You were presenting to the standing committee on appropriation, and I will allow you to introduce your team before you start presenting. I know we gave you a short notice, but you had a capable team, so I'm sure you will respond accordingly. We all listened to the medium-term budget policy statement last week, and the committee would like to get your views with respect to the overall assessment of the MPBTF for 2014, with the challenges, opportunities, allocating efficiency, but also how to detect those issues of accelerating growth, infrastructure investment, job creation, issues of education and health, the case of legislative obviously, your input will help the committee to be able to look into the MPBTF in a more critical way and be able to advise Parliament according to the issues. So thank you very much for responding, but a short notice. I do promise that next time we will give you enough time. We are working under pressure ourselves, so we'll understand. I know that you were saying you had to revise the presentation of lunch. I know members always complain that they want to get the presentation much earlier. But as you say, the invitation from our side was also very short, so we'll understand. So welcome. We have put time aside until lunchtime to be able to ensure that we can present properly and be able to engage with members of the committee. Members of the committee will introduce themselves as they speak later during the engagement. Is that fine? Yes, Darren, something?
No.
Oh. Okay, I think let me allow Professor Chisano to then take the floor.
Okay, thank you, Professor. While we do realize that the time is short, we also understand that the document came out on the 22nd, and you have a responsibility to convene this meeting the following week. It does not give you enough time either to be able to do the work you're supposed to do. So we are sympathetic to the challenges that we're facing. We have a team here that is going to be taking us through a number of areas. We may not cover 100% everything, but we'll cover where we believe that we've got enough research or skills to be able to assist you through the process. So I just want to introduce the team that is going to be leading. We'll start with Dr. Harry Toros, and he is the acting executive director for economic performance. And he's an economist, you know, by training, and therefore be able to help us not only in terms of the specific area, but also the broad aspect of looking at this budget that we're reviewing now. So next to me is Dr. Relay Reddy, who is the executive director responsible for our program on education and skills development. And then next to her is Professor Lightness Simbai, who is the head of our program on HIV and AIDS, the HSRC. And then next to him is Professor Dimitri Labadoria, who is heading our public health program, you know, at the HSRC. And the second down is Dr. Benita Mulman, who is a specialist and is also a postdoctoral fellow, and she will be talking to us, you know, in some of the areas that we're going to be discussing later on. Let me start by saying that we have reviewed the budget that has been put in front of us, and it's a budget that is difficult in the sense that it is projecting a growth in expenditure, and at the same time, is cautioning us about economic growth in the country. The economy will not grow commensurate with the expenditure, meaning that we are likely to have deficits, and therefore we are likely to have a situation where the government is to borrow in order to be able to contribute to, you know, addressing the challenges that the country actually faces. South Africa is part of the chapter of, I'm sorry, I forgot to introduce Dr. Danny Flagler. I've still not seen there as an executive director responsible for democracy and governance, you know, for the agency. My apologies for that. So the economy is not going to be doing very well, and we need to do better. We are part and parcel of the BRICS economy, and four of the BRICS countries are actually in the top 10, you know, largest economies in the world. And we won't be the largest economy because we are small, you know, so the number of people in the population are roughly 2 million if you compare us to all the other partners. But that means that we still have to really grow our economy far better than we're actually growing it at the moment. And our team is going to be looking at those issues that will help us to actually grow the economy, where the investment is supposed to be in order to be able to grow this economy and meet the demand that the country has in terms of development. So we'll start with Dr. Evan Turok.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about these big issues. I'm going to talk for about a few minutes or so on just to set the context a little bit for what we are, with my colleagues here today, and then to go into some of the economic themes in a bit more detail. I think these are the three themes I will address that are on the agenda: accelerating growth, infrastructure investment, and job creation. The context is really important to understand where the Minister of Finance and the MPB is coming from. The slowdown in economic growth has been quite striking and poses big challenges for South Africa. We're hoping for a recovery and for the faster growth the last couple of years, but the global situation has been weak. Our main market, Europe, has been very lackluster, and this has created big challenges. China is not slowing down. This has created big challenges for the South African economy. Government debt is at a high level. For the last 6 years, following the global recession, government has been deliberately borrowing to spend to try to stimulate the economy, and that has left us in a position with internationally high levels of debt. The budget deficit, reflecting this, is also at quite a high level. The foreign trade deficit, that's the difference between exports and imports, that is not looking good either. We've been importing more than exporting, and so our trade deficit is also at a worrying level. So combined, that has created a difficult situation for the government. In addition, we have seen an increase in public spending, particularly in terms of employment, school service employment. And the interesting figure in the statement that 30% now of all non-farm wages constitute a public sector employment. So it constitutes 3% basically of all earnings in South Africa as a measure of the growth. And that's an increase of about 20% 10 or 15 years ago. The investment climate, I think there's a general consensus across society that the investment climate is not great at the moment. The confidence on the part of business and investors is not high, and the consumers are also feeling the pinch from borrowing to try to sustain their living standards. So it's a bit of a gloomy outlook, right, for this statement. Critically important to explain, I think, where where the ministers of finance are coming from. He's quite frank in his statement that a more prudent approach is necessary than in the recent past. He talks about restraint, he talks about taking the pain. These are quite strong statements to be coming from the minister. And efficiency is one of the kind of recurring words in the statement, trying to find more efficiency in public services in order to get more bang for the buck, get more out of what we're spending in order to achieve our objectives more effectively. So that's the sort of overall context in which the statement is couched. Strong commitment is made to contain public spending, the growth of public spending. I mentioned it's been growing over the last 6 years in response to recession to try and counteract the impact of the slowdown. The government minister is now saying we need to contain that growth in public spending to limit the growth in borrowing. So it's not actually cut. Now, some people have used the word austerity. It's not technically the same as austerity in Europe, for example, or in some other countries, because we're not actually talking about cutting the total spending envelope. Nevertheless, the growth will be pruned, the growth will be trimmed, so there will be, for some departments, less resources, and there will be constraints on public spending. But it's not an absolute cut in spending. It's important to say. The third point is that, and this is quite new, a tougher approach to managing state entities such as Eskom and South African Airways. A clear distinction being made between their commercial activities, their commercial objectives, and their developmental objectives. In other words, the profit-making, surplus-making activities, and the broader activities, broader objectives of these entities. And quite strong statements about the need for the government to reduce the kind of handouts that have been given to some of these entities in the past. A greater pressure on these entities to be self-financing. And one of the ways of achieving this is through selling non-strategic or non-core assets, such as property and shareholdings. A number of these entities have shareholdings, and there's no need, the minister saying, for these entities to have some of these assets. They can sell more to try to raise whatever capital they need to maintain the viability of their operations. I'm going to come back to the issue of property because it's quite an interesting one, in my view, for another objective that the minister is trying to achieve. I'll say something in a few minutes' time. Another important point made in the statement is the commitment to increase private sector investment in public infrastructure. Right, given the constraints, the financial constraints, the statement is emphasizing the need to secure private sector investment and indeed private sector expertise in public infrastructure. I'm going to come back to this point and expand a little bit because it's another important statement and departure from where we've been in the recent past, with important implications that I think the committee needs to take into account. There will be some tax increases that the minister has flagged, but there are no details of where those tax increases will come, that we have to wait for the budget early next year. And then overriding all of this, a lot of the commentary in the press has been saying, well, this is new and interesting. Some people have been a bit critical, but on the whole, there's been quite a lot of, I think, endorsement that given the difficult context, there's not really been much choice for the minister. But the key comment has been, can the government really implement this? Can it really get private sector investment? Can it really contain the growth in public spending? Right? Is this feasible? Is this realistic? Or is there insufficient capability within the Treasury and within across government as a whole to impose this more prudent approach to public spending? Okay. So let's look at the three key planks that I mentioned right at the beginning, the accelerating growth, the infrastructure, and the job creation. Just a few minutes on each one. So the growth forecasts are disappointing, really, considering only in February, where we were talking about 2.7% for 2014, we're now talking 1.4%. 3.2% we were talking about for next year, now we're down to 2.5%. 3.5% for 2016, now only 2.8%. So this is quite a wake-up call for the country. That, you know, slower growth than we expected. And there's also the implications for jobs, for taxes, for investment, and so on, right? So very, it's quite significant, this. And the implication is that we need to try and get mobilized private investment, right, to try and compensate for the decline in tax revenues and for the decline in other consumer expenditure. So the government looking to increase involvement in strategic infrastructure projects. The Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission is now charged with opening up. They've been rather secretive in the last few years. They have revamped their website, and there's now much more commitment to engage with the private sector to see where there are opportunities to try and mobilize private investment into some of our key strategic projects. And that will be very interesting to see, you know, where there's the appetite on the part of the private sector to come to the party and to commit to these big, important public sector projects. Removing obstacles to private investment, streamlining, reducing red tape. We can hear a lot more of this in the months ahead. Trying to find ways of overcoming some of our regulatory hurdles to try and mobilize private investment. I'm sure you'll want to talk more about that because it applies to hospitals, it applies to maybe schools, it applies to roads, e-tolls. We've seen some of the controversy over e-tolls. You know, the implications of this are quite significant for government, for managing public policies and projects. And then the statement also talked a lot about reindustrialization and boosting exports to the rest of Africa. We know that Africa, the markets are expanding more strongly than South Africa. A number of our businesses are expanding into Africa because of the market opportunities, and clearly now the government's trying to get behind this, seeing it as a great potential for growth, a source of growth in the future. The second theme is around infrastructure investment, which stands a little bit on the point I've just made. Infrastructure has been growing, spending, but quite close. And that is a source of discussion in the public space, in the media. Why? We've talked a lot about accelerating infrastructure, but we're quite slow to get it going. Clearly some of these projects are complicated. The red rail, getting more freight onto the railway, getting more locomotives. We've got objectives of procurement as alongside just building infrastructure. So, you know, planning the project takes time. I think this has been part of it. Finding the ways of financing these infrastructure projects has also been a challenge. So we're now at about 20% of GDP. The objective is to increase infrastructure investment further, but the challenge, of course, is the financing of that. I think much of the reason that business in particular has been quite critical of government for the slow progress in infrastructure investment is that much of that infrastructure has been around social development, social programs such as schools, hospitals, housing, water plantation, electrification, rather than more narrowly defined economic infrastructure, such as the roads, the railways, the ports, right? That, I think, is where the business sector would like to see more investment in infrastructure, around key blockages to investment. The third point is that communications and transport, communications meaning broadband for short, transport being the rail investment, and the new rolling stock for both freight and for public transport, metro rail. It's taken time to get these programs up and running because of the procurement issues, because of the complexity and the size of these procurement, huge multi-billion man programs. So it's just organizing those investments are taking time. And the final point is that, as I've been saying before, that it's really quite uncertain about whether the private sector will come to the party, whether institutions, the banks, the insurance companies, whether global finance will be interested in joining with government in partnerships of various kinds to fund the infrastructure we desperately need. So jobs is clearly our number one priority for the country. And in a context of slow growth, that implies that job growth will also be slow. And we can certainly see a change in the trajectory of public sector employment. We've been seeing strong growth, something like 1 million more jobs in the public sector over the last decade. That has changed, and we can see now a flatlining of public sector employment, both in government, national, provincial, and municipal government, but also in the state entities that are going to come under tighter scrutiny, I think, from government. It's also early days for infrastructure investment and seeing the jobs that will flow from the growth in infrastructure. Private sector employment will also be restrained over the next 3 years by the slow growth of the economy and by the blockages in infrastructure and the rising administered prices of Eskom, electricity, water, port charges, and other things that business complains about. Now, I mentioned that the Minister talking much more about manufacturing and about exports to Africa. I think the key feature of these part of the economy is that they're not labor intensive. You don't get too many jobs when you expand manufacturing output by 10 or 20% these days, because much of manufacturing is more capital intensive, there's more mechanization than existed in the past. And we see that very clearly with the automotive program. It's been the government's most successful industrial policy, right? Expanding the car industry. But we haven't seen many, many jobs coming out of the substantial government investment, at least directly. We've seen jobs down in the supply chain, but not directly in car industry. And my final point I'll spend a couple of minutes on is what I think is quite a new and important emphasis coming through the state. And is a departure, I think, from what we've seen in the last 5 years or so. And that is the emphasis on urbanization and on cities. The first priority is quite striking. The first priority in the statement, chapter 4 of the statement, the first expenditure priority is called dynamic cities. Right? That's a departure. It's not education, it's not health, it's not agriculture. And I wanted to spend a couple of minutes saying on this because I think it's extremely significant and it's relevant to what Minister is also saying about trying to mobilize private investment, because I think the opportunities are greater in the urban context for mobilizing private investment, crowding in private investment, and where the markets are growing more strongly and where addressing, I think, poverty and inequality is also easier than elsewhere. So the first interesting statement is a change in language. Well-planned and well-managed urbanization can accelerate economic growth. Okay, so we've tended to talk about urbanization as a problem because it leads to social dislocation, because it leads to a burden on urban municipalities, because it's just destabilizing of our society. The way we've talked about urbanization traditionally, the language here is quite much more positive. Right. Well-planned, well-managed urbanization can accelerate economic growth, which is clearly what the government is desperate to do. So I think that is, as I say, a departure. It talks about the need for massive municipal investment to stimulate growth, to maintain our decaying infrastructure, our sewers, our stormwater systems, our electricity networks, and so on, and to expand basic services. So to accommodate urbanization effectively and avoid informal settlements and squalid living conditions for our people. So massive investment is the language. A new approach to local government infrastructure financing. So this is interesting also in the same municipalities cannot cope with the current funding arrangements. Just relying on property rates is not sufficient to meet the infrastructure needs, the spending needs of our metros. we need to find other ways of funding the infrastructure requirements of our city. And the Treasury is going to work with financial institutions to expand municipal debt markets, to encourage municipalities to borrow more to finance their infrastructure. They don't tend to borrow as much as they could, many of our municipalities. So this is also clearly resonates with the getting the private sector more closely involved and finding new ways of funding public infrastructure. So that's all, I think, important and new. And in the same line, the government is now talking more seriously about spatial transformation. We're trying to address our townships, our dormitory settlements on the edge of our cities, recognizing that this is not just an issue of equity and inclusive social inclusion. It is actually an issue of efficiency. If our cities are fragmented and sprawling and dispersed, but that is inefficient because we haven't spent a lot of money on transport, getting people into work, getting pupils to schools, getting people to hospitals and so on. Fragmented cities are inefficient as well as inequitable. And this is really coming home now to government, that if we promote more compact, more densified, more efficient cities, that we're actually going to get the major economic benefit as well as important social benefit. They talk about aligning planning, aligning infrastructure investment. So that our infrastructure doesn't ignore a spatial plan that the metros have spent a lot of time and consulting on. As they follow the plan, that we're getting coordination in relation to urban development. So this act is really, really important. Reforming infrastructure grants to local government to scale up the provision of well-located and affordable social housing. So this is, again, this kind of new language. We're not talking about RDP housing on the periphery. We're talking about well-located and affordable social housing. It's a mixture of housing, rental housing, and not just other giveaway RDP housing. And a more serious commitment to upgrading informal settlements where people already live. $600 billion in grants over 3 years to assist in providing bulk infrastructure, electrification, schools, clinics, and water. But the government is looking to actually increase funding for municipal infrastructure. And then my final point is about the RDP housing program. Just want to make a point about this, because I think there is a realization following from what I said about inefficient urban areas, and going back to the older apartheid urban structure, there is now, I think, a more serious commitment to review what we've been doing in housing to overcome the problem of creating dormitory settlements on the periphery. The current approach to housing is also being reviewed to develop an approach that's more effective and affordable, and which will help to densify cities. It's quite interesting. I was in a workshop, as one mentioned last week, with some very prominent international economists. And I talked about our housing program, and I emphasized that we've made some big achievements. 2.7 million houses, 1 in 5 South Africans now living in an RDP house. Some significant achievements, but also some concerns about how we've invested and where we've invested in particular. And these international economists were highly critical of what we've done. And the phrase they used, which really struck me, they said we've destroyed value. Right? We've destroyed value by building dormitory settlements on the edge of our city, far from jobs, far from amenities. And we've destroyed value. Right? So when the minister talks about efficiency and being careful and how we spend public money, this review that talked about is quite appropriate. We shouldn't be destroying value. We should be creating value. We need to create settlements and places and urban areas, that are efficient and equitable. They're not reproducing inefficiency and destroying value. So this is relevant to the property sales that we talked about. We know that organizations like Transnet, right, Transnet, Portnet, they own a lot of the well-located land. We need to persuade our entities, Transnet, Portnet, the Ministry of Defense, that these sites that they own in our cities need to be given up for well-located housing. So this is all I've read. Thanks very much. I spent a bit too long, but that's my contribution.
Okay, so while Dr. Vijay Reddy is coming to give a presentation, just to say he's been joined by Dr. Gideon Mattel, Please. So basically, it's like right out of control for our scientific knowledge and human innovation program at the Cisco. We'll take questions at the end of the discussion.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. If you see the difference of how the students are seen, I think that in this presentation on education and research, I'm focused on questions you asked about the allocation effectiveness, the state resource effective allocation. And so in terms of drawing on research we've undertaken in the society, that's what I would like to focus on. Now, in the budget itself, as we all know, that education and skills is given the largest proportion of the budget. Maybe the CEO of the fire can have the largest time. I don't want to try and explain why education and skills are so key to growth, development, and employment. We all know that when we keep eyes on resources, infrastructure, development, then do we have the skills and capabilities in order to achieve that? And so, in the budget, $833 billion is proposed for the 3-year period for education and skills development, education skills. And the basic education receives 15% of the budget, which is the highest sectoral allocation. And in post-school education and training, it is the fastest growing share of the budget and will continue to expand. So clearly, in the country, the commitment to education and skills is a priority. And so everybody is looking at each of the education and skills allocation. Do we have the returns on this investment? And it is allowing us both as a society to develop and for the economy to grow. So, in thinking about the presentation, you know, after 20 years, how do we look at a budget and allocation perspective? Just use the indicator that it's a growing budget, but that's a blunt indicator. I think we need to find new language and new thinking about how we analyze the budget, and from the research perspective, hopefully we can be ahead of the curve in asking some of these questions. And because of time, I'm not going to go very in detail on all the slides. One of the things is that we need to look at new complexities and nuances rather than just a global perspective. And in looking at schooling and education, we can't only look at education or cities separately. These are all interwoven, and the location of city or the special location of an individual in society, it also informs their educational performance. So we need to have a more integrated way of looking at this. And for the education of the schooling sector, I want to look at both schooling and the home as two main factors that inform educational performance. And with regard to the skills in this presentation, I want to refer to how does skills development link to economic or societal development rather than skills in a vacuum. So for basic education, we look at performance and differentiating the sub-regions in the context of the home and school. And for post-school education and training, we need to go further and ask what type of post-school education training, what kind of skills, and how we're focusing on skill planning. I'm going to just keep this for now. Again, to repeat a truth, something that you know, the link between development and mathematics or educational score is well known. And mathematics is a proxy for analytic thinking skills that we can work in terms of going into higher level skills. You see from the diagram there that South Africa with the red dot is, we should be performing at a level somewhere there. In terms of this is mathematical achievement and this is our human development index, and we plot that together, and here's the different countries. South Africa's performance is well below what it should be in terms of its human development index. I mean, the human development index, we look at literacy, life expectancy, and GDP per capita. So there is an underperformance in the system. Now, what I want to refer to is, why there's an underperformance one of the studies that the ASA sought to undertake is to participate in an international mass design study, the TRIM study. And one of the good things about the TRIM study is it allows us to measure trend over time. Yes, we are performing poorly. But when we, and the ASA sought to undertake the studies in 95, 99, 2002, 2011, we have a sense of them saying, how do we compare to ourselves over time? If we look at this diagram, we notice that from 95 to 2002, we didn't show any changes. The mean score was stuck to certain points. We've all seen these data headlines about it. And that could be one of the consequences of over, you know, with 94 and the changes, the structural changes in the educational system, curriculum changes, what the changes that occurred. One of the unintended consequences is that it did affect educational reform. But even just from 2002 to 2011, in terms of that line, for the first time, we were able to see some change in the mean score. Still low, but an improvement. And what this change translates to is that for 2002 to 2011, on average, our performance of our kids improved by 1.5 grades. So they're not in grade 9 students, they're not performing in grade 9, they were performing way below, but during that time they improved by that amount. We will again be revisiting in 2011, and we hope to see that change. So it allows us to see that there is change, but not enough. I thought very quickly to show you the change by provinces, and just one good news for you. I can also just say on this one, it's important to note that the best change occurred at the lowest level. In other words, those kids that came from perhaps the poorest environment in schools, and perhaps we were speculating on some of these things, maybe the poor policies, maybe these income grants, etc., and households contributed to that. In terms of provinces, the best change that we saw was Eastern Cape and Limpopo. That even in Limpopo from 2011 to 2011, and these individual scales, we see the best change. But we need to change now. Another point that I want to make using this, the TIM study is that, think about it, that the total score is about 1,000. If you get over 400, you pass. It's a crude measure. Now, what we did was to plot how our performance was against a few other countries. Now, for South Africa, it had a longer tail, meaning that, unfortunately, you know, over 75% of our kids didn't make the 400 mark. And just 25% made it. And so we looked against some improving our performance here. But the other side of the coin is that when we look at the top performance, over 625 marks, South Africa has 1% of the top 10. Norway also has 1%. And we need to also, as we look at education, consider drive for the SP goals, but we need to incorporate the excellence and our top performance. How are we going to get our thought leaders, our future academics, etc.? So that area is also equally important. As we think forward, we also need to set realistic expectations. We couldn't estimate that, you know, for every 4 years, if you improve by 40 points, by one grade level, that would be what our expectation. We cannot expect, as we have over the 6 results, that each year we look at it and we say, wow, the massive expansion becomes difficult. And we sort of speculate maybe by 2023 we have a score on this study that we will be more in terms of what we would like to see. I thought it's just important because the home is so important to also say if we want to look at education for families, how is the home change? Now what we did in this, we looked at home resources. But we classified it in terms of those that are no free schools, those in CK, and those in independent schools, because it allows us some sort of instrument, policy instrument, because these are the designated schools and the allocations are given. I want to just I want to point out the vast difference between the characteristics in low-key school, the kids in low-key school that he came. And if we look at computers, one quarter of children in low-key schools are computers, for half in TK, and three quarters in independent schools. If we look at running tap water, 39% of children in low-key schools have tap water, which means 40% don't. 80% in TK, and 92% in independent schools. Water flush toilets, one third of the children in low-key schools have their own water flush toilets. There might be communal toilets. 2/3 in TK and 86% in independent. So as we try to look at the education budget, we need to also look at the broader set of societal and contextual issues that inform their performance. Very quickly, again, it is important that we break down into different groups. If we characterize by schools such as low TK and independent, we see the change in the difference in the score. The indicators are close to the international mean of 500. Also, if you look at it at the school measure, those are 5% in low-C schools, 44% in TK, and 31% in independent. We look at the average age. In low-C schools, it's 16.2%. In independent, it's 16.4%. This would suggest a high level of repetition. And the question we need to ask is, if repetition, what are we doing for those kids that are repeating? The home resources, I want to draw attention to school safety. Because again, we ask children, you know, very bullied in school. And in low-key schools, only 20%, one in five, said they were never experienced bullied. In TK schools, 36%, one third of kids said they never experienced bullied. And independent schools, 46%. So there might be big differences in their course, but almost all society is experiencing bullying in schools, and that's an issue. I want to maybe just skip over to that, to refer on the second aspect of what I want to present, and making an argument that if we're looking at the budget for post-school education and training, we also need to ask the question of what type of skills are needed for the country. It's not simply an allocation for education and training. There needs to be a higher sense of directing resources to the kinds of skills that support economic growth. And what we propose is, and we're working with the Department of Higher Education and Training on developing a skills planning mechanism, and I want to refer to what we would propose in our skills planning mechanism. That if we're looking at skills and skills planning, we need to see it in a holistic light. We would want to look at development at the national level, at national level development, and to look at skills demand at the sectoral level or at firms and education training, and then at skills demand. And in order to develop any skills planning system, at the national level, we need to link up with the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation and Cabinet, who develops the national plan, integrated plan for development. At the other end, at the level of institutions, we have firms who have demand for skills, and education and training providers who run courses and work with the teachers. We have universities that offer education and training, education colleges, especially the technical vocational education colleges for these who are largely responsible for skills for the economy. And these people provide institutional plans. So in terms of our planning, we need to look at both the top-down and the bottom-up approach. All of these people is engaged with the Department of Higher Education and Training as the key agency for post-school education and training. And we have produced this post-school education and training plan. Again, what is being proposed is that within DHES, there is a planning unit that is required, because if you've got the massive resources, it needs to be directed properly for the massive return on investment. But DHA can't work alone in skills planning. It needs to analyze what are the skills needs of the growth strategies, of the economic strategies, the strategic integration, what are skills that, needed for the strategic integration projects, What are the skills needed to become business and labor? And so we need a kind of system which, where there's an engagement of natural level economic plans and repurposing a system as demand-related, the analysis of the skills needed from the macro level economic plan, which then feeds into DHEB, so a skills planning council, and that informs what kind of education and training takes place, so that we use the funding effectively. And in the system, of course, being a system, we think that all parts should work together, and it's a much integrated system for skills planning for the country, rather than the steep levels of planning. Again, just to finish off today, in terms of looking at this, there are some concerns that to look at these monthly achievements. I see that in terms of basic education, they say they've delivered 19 million of 54 million workbooks. Difficult to catch up by the end of the year because we need workbooks at the beginning of the year. And after school schools, it's 28 out of 100. But they've exceeded in terms of the shuttle bus, the food feeding scheme, and learning literature courses. So good. For the post-school education and training in terms of the 6 months, I think that they have a bit of catch-up to do in the headcount at the tech colleges, at the technical education education college.
Thanks very much, Professor Kee. I think now we move to Professor Julia and myself. And we'll be talking about science, technology, and innovation at the age of student community development.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Can I comment on the role of science, technology, and innovation as enablers to socioeconomic development? I'm going to focus on an opportunity to use the government's role in this area to manage the difficulties of the current reality facing South Africa, as well as positioning South Africa for a buoyant future. And in saying that, I recognize that the MTPS identifies opportunities for structural reform, diversification and transformation of the South African economy. And I will speak to ways in which investment in science, technology, and innovation can support these objectives. And I particularly want to take up what I regard as a very important focus in the medium-term budget policy statement, where there are three particular sectoral activities identified. Being energy, including renewable energy technologies, mining, telecommunications, and ICT. Those three sectors, in my mind, represent both existing strengths of the South African economy, being mining, as well as forward-looking activities, particularly on the renewable energy technology side. And in order for South Africa to reap the benefits of investments in those areas or to position those activities as areas of supporting growth, there will be requirements for investments in science, technology, and innovation. I want to suggest that one way of examining and assessing the budget statement is whether or not it considers that the state can act in at least three important ways. The first is as a policymaker and regulator. And the state can act in this way to signal what are the high value and high growth areas that South Africa should be supporting and intensifying its efforts in. In particular, capital goods and services in the area of mining, building on our strengths in broadband, ICT networks and technologies, and supporting growth towards the transition to low carbon production and consumption systems, are areas that can and have the potential to produce high value and high growth. This would all require the state to have a consistent role as policymaker and regulator and to use the budget available itself. The project or program in the area of energy, the independent power program, is a good example of the state using its role to signal and to therefore generate private sector investment in a transition to renewable energy technology. Secondly, under budget cutting and cost containment
environment, such as the one that is indicated by the medium-term budget statement. It is important also for the state to demonstrate that it can be effective, capable, and efficient by acting to accelerate problem-solving and solution development in areas such as health, education, and social services. And in that way, public sector innovation and signaling that the South African state can become a catalyst for problem solving in important areas becomes even more important under budget cutting and cost containment environment. Finally, the state has a very important role to play as a large procurer of goods and services in priority sectors. And therefore, the state can through perhaps adaptation and changing of its own requirements for purchasing goods and services actually promote a mindset of genuine innovativeness where we emphasize novelty and promote usefulness and relevance. So it becomes a signal that innovation and to be innovative is not only about chasing the new. What this means specifically for budget allocation is that in considering any changes to the existing budget, perhaps these three considerations can be used as criteria for assessing which allocations can be maintained and which can be furthered and enhanced. I want to end my remarks by identifying what I regard as an important opportunity for South African states, particularly in times of fiscal prudence and cost containment, which is to place much greater emphasis on supporting non-technological forms of innovation and putting greater emphasis on innovation for social purposes. I was heartened to see in the medium-term budget policy statement recognition of the importance of large-scale public programs such as the Community Work Program. And I would say that the work that we've been doing in this area suggests that budget support should be maintained and perhaps look for opportunities to strengthen cooperation between the various line ministries and departments that support this kind of work. Finally, I want to end by saying that the state can also demonstrate its role in strengthening innovation and innovativeness in the application of e-government, which was the ICT-enabled application, to deliver the services of the public sector, and also in leading public-private partnerships with the numerous programs and projects that are spearheaded by not-for-profit and NGO entities, which are facing great strain. If this approach was taken, not only would the state be responding to the realities of cost-effective delivery of public services, but it would also be building on the need for social cohesion, even in an environment of fiscal prudence.
Thank you, Dr. Matteo. We now have Mr. Michael Timai to talk to us about the European program HIV and AIDS in South Africa.
Thank you very much, Board Chair, Mr. Kille, and members of the committee for this opportunity to comment on the medium-term budget policy strategy. I'm sure we are all aware of the magnitude, in particular of both HIV, AIDS, and TB in our country. We ranked as number one in case of HIV, AIDS, and it's number three in case of TB in the world. So as a country, we have developed a national strategic plan which addresses both of these diseases. I will be sharing with you our comments on the aspects of the budget dealing with HIV, AIDS, and TB, as well as some aspects of health. I'll leave the rest of the comments on health to my colleague, Professor Kodagari. But I thought as a way of discussing this, that we need to begin by giving a context, what do we know about HIV and AIDS in particular. And I'm pleased that we are able to share
briefly some of the results that have come out of our own research at the HSC, which we do on behalf of the nation. So earlier this year, we released results from what is known as the South African National HIV Treatment Incident and Behavior Survey. I will just extract a few key slides highlighting some of the results. To start with, I want to talk about HIV prevalence. This is the total number of people who are living with HIV/AIDS in the country. From the survey that we conducted in 2012, we were able to establish based on testing spots of blood we collected from people across the country, because I'm in the lab, that about 12.2% of South Africans are infected with HIV. This is an increase of 10.6%, which we found in 2007. So there has been this increase. When we went out in terms of actual numbers, based on the limited population in the country, we estimate around 6.4 million South Africans are living with HIV and AIDS. Basically, this would be suggesting that the magnitude of this epidemic continues to increase. Just to discuss one aspect of the results that might be of interest to members, it's really to look at how HIV infections compare among people of different ages and different ethnic sexes. Basically, the slide I have shows how the two compare. The two shows the results from males. We're showing the prevalence. Sorry about that. I think no. It's just that. Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I'll go on from that. The point is to this slide really shows that HIV infections or levels of HIV infections are higher in general. They start earlier among women. If you look at 15 to 19 at the bottom there, that's the age group. Working up? All right. Someone's not working for me. If you see, it shows 0.7% for males, and almost 8 times as much prevalence, 5.6% among females. This is just among those aged 15 to 19. But this gender difference is seen until it picks up at the ages of 30 to 34 among women at 36%. Right? It picks a little bit later in the next age group, 35 to 39, among males at 28 to 87. But overall, our prevalence is higher among females compared to their male counterparts, except for those who are over 50. Very welcome. So this shows basically what we call the feminization of the epidemic. Now, one aspect of the HIV epidemic that we have been addressing as a country, and doing so fairly successfully, is treatment of those who qualify for treatment. Here that mention in passing that the eligibility of criterion that was used has changed from PD4 200 per cubic millimeter of blood in terms of number of PD4 cells that are part of our immunity system. Treatment now starts at 350. And from this, we were able to descend that out of the estimated 6.4 million, over 2 million were on treatment. This is back in 2012. You might have heard Yesterday, the Deputy President saying that he now is 2.7 million. And indeed, the policy statement does actually cite that we are currently 2.7 million people who are under treatment. So this is one component that does cost the system quite a bit. Overall, it's at 1.3% of those who are living with HIV. This is bound to go up. Right now, there are plans to increase the eligibility to 500, to start treatment much earlier than we have been doing so far. It is expected that by next year, we might actually have another 2 million people who will need to access treatment. And this is an important issue which we need to be factored in the budget. And as we discuss, the question is whether what is being allocated over the next 3 years cycle is adequate for them. Right. The study also showed breakdown that as we expect more women having access to treatment because of the antenatal services and prevention of mother to child programs. Right. I will skip the next slide, but just go to the next one, which shows a comparison in two graphs showing the health trend only among females in 2008, shown in blue. And that one in red shows what was found in 2012. Basically, what we see is the red curve has moved to the right. And if you also see it sits at a higher level, moved from 32.6 to 32.7 to 36. We believe this is evidence, among others, that shows people are living longer, and it mainly as a result of the treatment program. Apart from the treatment program, we also been able to measure new cases of infection. So we looked for how many people were infected in 2012, or estimated how many were. And there are two methods which we use for this, and I only talk about one method. Basically, the idea is we test drops of blood in a lab to find out how recently the person was infected. And when we did that, we found that new infections were at 1%. Remember, we are 53 million people. When you work it out, infections will be just about 460,000 people were newly infected in 2012. This highlights a challenge that we have, that yes, we're doing relatively well, which very well, on treatment, but unfortunately we are also getting new infections. So in terms of challenges, the suggestion to us that we need to double our efforts to actually talk this up, to prevent there being new infections, or to prevent there being as many new infections as we are occurring in 2012. We are in 2014 now. We don't know what the picture is like, but that's something which we need to address, and that requires resources. All right. One, we are emphasizing that there are still new infections occurring. Secondly, to another slide that shows what we've been able to do using the data that we have collected over 4 surveys that we have conducted. One in 2002, the next one in 2005, the third one in 2010, and the last one was in 2012. We are able, using the information we collected, to estimate how many new infections occurred in between the surveys. And on the right hand side, we show the larger age group of people in the reproductive age of 15 to 49. What we're showing from 2002 to 2005, it was the incidence was 2.2. But this has dropped as we move to 2005 and 2008, and then as we move from 2008 to 2012, it has remained fairly steady. However, when you disaggregate this information and look at what's happening amongst young people, there's a positive story happening there. Actually, among young people aged 15 to 24 years, there has been a decline, a significant decline in the levels of new infections happening from 2002 to 2012. So that's something positive. It means we actually need to carry on with the prevention message so that hopefully in the near future we will get to zero new infections, particularly among young people. Of course, we also need to address the issue of prevention among those who are older. So, in terms of the allocation, just briefly, we do welcome the fact that 11% of social spending was allocated to health. And we need also to highlight here the fact that comprehensive HIV and AIDS conditional grant is meant to grow about 30% a year over the 3-year cycle. According to the document, the last share of spending growth covers the expanding provision of antiretroviral drugs, as I said earlier, which now reach 2.7 million people. We welcome, as the previous speaker indicated, the emphasis on government which to improve the quality of our health services, just as they do other services. We wish to point out here that the government must be commended for allocating 32.6 million for the Department of Health for Ebola control and prevention measures, including support for affected West African countries. We think this reflects the true spirit of both Ubuntu and African Renaissance and clearly illustrates the excellent leadership that we are providing to the country, to the country. One of the issues that we thought we should mention here is that way back in 2001, our country did other countries from who are in the African Union made a declaration that they will try to budget up to 15% of all sorts of spending on health. Now, we just had earlier we're at 11%. I think this is one place where we might need to look at. I'm aware that there are only a couple of countries that in SADC that actually achieved that target today. One of the main messages in the results which I shared with you is to showcase that we are making great inroads in some aspects of the fight against HIV in the country, thanks to the well I mentioned today. Particularly when it comes to treatment. One notable achievement is South Africa is one of the few countries, the other being Botswana, they have Namibia, who contribute a large proportion of the funds that are required to support our national responses to HIV. In the case of South Africa, it's as high as 80%. This is the opposite of the situation in other countries, particularly in the SADC region, where actually they might be getting the bulk of the funding from outside and only contributing a little. So the government might be commended for that. However, we feel that the 30% that is being suggested as growth over the next 2 years might not be quite enough, bearing in mind the anticipated scaling up of NHR, which my colleague, Professor Levert, Darius will talk about briefly. But I have already alluded to the fact that because we are aiming to treat more people with this relaxation of the eligibility criterion for people to start shipment from 350 to 500, if we are going to have an addition of 2 million people requiring treatment, that is going to cost more. So there is a question whether what is being allocated over the next 3 years is adequate for that purpose. It's also worth mentioning, as Professor Stana did indicate earlier, that there is particularly an era where bilateral funding, donor funding, is being cut because we are classified as a middle-income, a higher middle-income country, that countries like the USA and Britain and other European countries are simply touching the amount of support that they are giving to our country. So over the next 3 years, we need to figure out ways in which we can address the shortfall that will result because of that. Perhaps worth mentioning as we get close to the end of our presentation is really to again re-emphasize the fact that our response to HIV and AIDS tend to be been excellent overall. In particular, where it has to do with treatment and testing. We've been able to test a lot of people who have found out about their HIV status, after which they've been able to access treatment. In fact, as we speak, there is a national campaign that's going on to test even more people. Now, the more people know, get to find out their HIV status, but this change in the criterion for testing treatment, that means that there are going to be a lot of new people, as I said earlier, requiring treatment. But what is important to highlight, the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, we still get getting a large number of people being newly infected. That's really problematic. In short, what I'm trying to say is we need to find ways in which we can balance the shift. Yes, treatment is important, but we should do as much as we can to prevent more new infections from taking place. And that way, some more of our investment as a country is needed. I think I will stop there. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Professor. I will go now to Professor Lavallare. He will take an extended talk so that can enable us to take that. Okay.
The beginning
time for the
members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Stana, members of the committee. We will be happy to take the idea of the importance that it has. It highlights the point of four slides as indicated. And I've got three four slides I want to share with you. The four, what we call epidemics in the country. The one is up here, on the top right, and we talked about HIV and TB, or primarily HIV. The other one is violence, and note that compared to the global burden, we have 2 times global average for English, and 5 times global average for homicide. The other major epidemic is top left, maternal, newborn, and child health. Because although we invest some money, we are still 2 to 3 times above the average of comparable countries. And of course we have the not so new entity, but an entity that is actually receiving a lot of attention now, and that is non-communicable diseases. And again, when we compare ourselves to the average of developing countries, our rate is 6 times higher than those countries. So these are the 4 major epidemics. And the reason for that is that we are undergoing the epidemiological transition. In other words, we are getting to the stage where other more developed countries have been and that's what it says in the third paragraph. And this is characterized by four negligences. The first one is that we have increased survival, and that's because of infectious diseases. On the other hand, we are having an aging population. Our life expectancy is already increasing after the drugs that we have. And then we've got the influence from our parish, let's say the globalization in terms of habits, smoking, alcohol, fast food, and so forth. We are known to be predisposed to non-communicable diseases. And we are getting more affluent in the country, which is actually quite positive. But at the same time, together with that, there's incomes rise in low and middle socioeconomic income countries, then the expenditure on food is not necessarily on the right foods, and definitely not in terms of lifestyle. So we have what I call here the triple burden of disease, which is actually the quadruple phase. Or the quadruple burden of disease is without injury, and that is the communicable diseases that I just would have heard my colleagues talk about, about HIV. The non-communicable diseases, which I will talk about now, is the virus and injury. Now the health priorities in four bullets is a growing epidemic, yes, in our country, of non-communicable diseases. But more importantly, the implications for the healthcare system. If we don't stop this group of diseases, we are not going to afford healthcare in this country in time to come. And that is the fact. And to give you an idea of the immensity of the problem, one third of our people, and one out of three people, or one out of five people, depending on what factor you're talking about, have hypertension. They have diabetes, or they have to excuse diabetes. They have high blood pressure. They eat fast food. That's huge numbers. Yeah. They don't exercise in their suit. And importantly, they feel that what they eat and drink is healthy, so there is no need to actually change it. I elaborated to that point because of the next bullet, which is called behavioral intervention. How do you actually convince people? This has all caused of complications. How do we convince our people that maybe there's a different way of doing things? So behavioral science and behavioral intervention are extremely complex, costly, and they take time. Then, of course, we have the issue of maternal infant and child mortality. For the past 20 years, the growth of our children, newborns, has been impaired, and 20% or more of them have died if they don't grow high protein. And we don't know why, and we need to understand the reason. So we are focusing on what we call, what we think we have been missing, the early childhood development programs. Then the rest of the population is not going, any further in terms of needs. Adolescent health needs attention, as well as that of adults and older citizens, and the new development, of course, of which the President Stanley spoke about, that is the BRICS collaborative framework. And when you compare health reality with country growth, there are some areas that we are doing well, but not very well. So, in repeating what Professor Spire said regarding the budget allocation, it's not a matter of lack of growth. It is that the growth is so small that we are lacking to run out of money. So important, very important, apart from the HIV, considerations like the ones I summarized here. Just the one in the other side. we need to make it succeed. And we are determined to make it succeed because it's going to at least provide a home for which people can seek help and can be looked after. But now, in order to make it succeed, we need information. We have to understand how the pilots are going, how to involve the DDs, whether people are willing to pay. The money has to come from somewhere. Whether we can have alternative funding of our hospitals or our clinics, whether we should have autonomous hospitals, and whether the cost and consequences of SDs are affordable. We have to put it. These are all studies that cost, just examples that cost a lot of money. And when you bear in mind the expenditure of this provision, like you spoke about, being inadequate and projecting so, at least this as an issue of any time, as the issue of something in the public diseases, and then we start thinking whether we have care that we have time. The last point I want to make is that the other big change, and I repeat it because it's very important, my colleagues, is that now the funding for the source of knowledge that the councils, the research council, I'll put here the APS as a example, for big national areas that tell us where is the health of medicine or the nation going, and actually diminishing that approach. And that has to run, we run the danger if funding is in the condition.
A quarter of our African children planted by age 2, which is in the short of the age.
defining the strongest predictor of the schooling or specific level wages and stuff like that. So you can see what we mean in future development. This is the graphic illustration in terms of the human brain development, and as you can see on conception, 2 years often is referred to as the importance of the first 1,000 days. And so to emphasize the importance of conception to 2 years old, we reflected the brain development. And what we see is that investment in threefold programs, ECG, is a larger return in terms of human capital. We're going to be trying to focus more on post-school job training, which is a set of that's not important to see, but we just have that in combination with the emphasis on threefold programs. So they're seeing ECG services, the provision of population level services as opposed to a number of small programs operating in public will require significant new investment. These investments will benefit children immediately as well as long-term benefits for children, families and society at large. Given the way brain development operates, it is difficult and extremely expensive to get the same returns through investment in every year. The effects of ECD investment, like equality, a powerful mechanism to assist the redistribution, better health, reduce the risk of chronic disease and promote personal and social health, more education, better learning, more schooling, stronger economy, higher wages and greater productivity, and better society, less crime, violence, and greater social cohesion. So the essential conditions for ECD, nutrition and health care, opportunities for early learning, safety and nutrition, responsive parenting, and family support. Education strategy of services, health and nutrition, birth education, which is insane, as of absolutely getting that right, social assistance and services, also being definitely included in terms of that, but often we seem to be lacking more in terms of parental support and opportunities for learning. If I refer earlier to Professor Hopkins, who identified the 560 billion in grants over the years assisting providing about infrastructure, education, food, training. So for us to think a little bit broadly around what the investment in schools actually means, how do we invest in education beyond our more conventional approach focusing on post-education and education. Thank you very much. Our last presentation was given by Professor Daniel Black.
Thank you, Chairperson and members of the committee. My colleague earlier indicated to you that the importance of the current climate, the whole question of the fiscal consolidation investment, and what's the importance of that for future economic growth. The point I would like to make is that also through the presentation to pick up that there's a need to continually cushion the presence that standard households experience from students who are vulnerable, and that we need to have more efficient and effective use of social expenditure. With common requirement of the similar economic development and growth. Here is an element of containment of expenditure to contribute to fiscal consolidation, including consider prudent utility of fiscal resources. Needless to say, there's probably a need to start thinking about aggressively implementing the National Development Plan and even term expenditure framework. But we need to note that our plan is not legislative that you'll find in Malaysia, given a big result approach to planning by government has inherited being as a result of the skills of studying economies like Malaysia. Then also picking up in the NDP a deprivatization of the 2015 period, 20-year period, of the general public service, which is projected to decline by a real annual average of 0.6 over the next 3 years. So is there a quick standstill on that, on terms of the public wage? There are concerns about the public sector wage bill. There is a lower rate of increase in public sector remuneration, which is over the period. Government spending needs to improve its effectiveness in general productivity, out of the lower spending on public wage. There's concern in the growth in compensation of employees. They're set to decrease between 2012 and 2014 it was 0.85%, but it will set up off to 6.5 per annum during 2014, 2015, 2017, 2018. Another matter that I would like to raise, which is not in the slide, is that we've seen over the period of 2011, 2012 to 2014, 2015, that compensation of employees in the public service rose to 27.4%. However, over the period 2014-15 to 2017-18, will be around 21.7%. More concerns of with regard to the productivity capacity of the public service relative to public wage spending. There is concern with regard to lower government consumption, but also how that will produce prudent management of public sector wage. In essence, there's a need. Some of these are very soft comments relative to the public wage bill, because the need for us now is about the end of the 20th century to determine what is the size and shape of the state administration and public services below the level of quality and quantity. So there's also a need then to start looking at what should be a solid public wage multi-year agreement, given there's a need to ensure stability, certainty and stability. If I can return to the slide again, what we've also seen is that given a need for investment in certain development and how to place a greater role in innovation, productivity and economic growth, it is surprising to see the low interest on the list of this particular priority. There is a strong move to create greater distribution of funds via the local equitable share to poor resource municipalities. It will contribute to making the distribution more equitable at a margin. However, spending ability has also capacity of municipalities should constantly be monitored so the benefit is at disadvantage in terms of service delivery by lack of capacity. In particular on this one, the social phrase is always internal capacity and govern. There's a need to look at holding strong capacity to be able to use the municipalities are must also use its available resources more efficiently and effectively, including regular updating of indigenous registers for the basic services improves and also improves access to these services. But there's a need also then to look at, because on the one hand, expanding basic service elements of question of policy in this field, with the whole question of sanitation provision in certain parts of the country. The whole issue of the basic approach from the Minister of COPTA during a summit with the CEOs and executive mayors and mayors, and also provincial and national government, it shows to the NPDS consistency with that, and also the continuity of a focus in administrative capacity approach, especially improving financial management, service delivery, and also accountability. It is a bold statement that the NPDS is making, and also in the Minister's speech, that failures in supply of electricity, water and sanitation services have had a negative impact on public confidence, and clearly there needs to be interventions to restore that. We've seen since the new government came in place that there's been shifts, conscious shifts, and essentially a national macro-organization of the state, or reorganization of the state, intent to improve integrated capacity, and also the consolidated function as articulated in the NPDS. In particular, there's been a shift of the telecommunications and postal services, but also certain water and sanitation to your new ministry. And hopefully there will be a much more greater concentrated impact and development of services in particular. There's also, in terms of the capacity question and capable state, a consistency in programs and policies, a consistency in particular between the interim strategic framework to the outcome-based priorities to the MCPPS, and that is also found in the adjustment in the estimated national expenditure of the different departments. I think the case not only a good practice of stability enhancement in the network, better policy systems and practices, but also a consolidation of innovative administrative capacities within the state. However, there is a need for greater long-term planning and efficient resource allocation. There needs to be a way to ensure during our planning cycles to create stability and consistency and try to move out of the shifting of plans that has been funded. Don't want to be aware of continuous reprioritization. There is a cap currently placed by the MCPPS on some property services, and it also through that continues to propagate cost containment. But also the lamenting of productivity capacity of the public service that allows the public waste spending. What is important is to recognize through this kind of consultancy services, the capping, it is a need to continuously start considering using by government departments, using national, provincial government departments, and also a greater utility for the strategy council, as opposed to going to the open market where the risk of exposure of the procurement system and continuous fraud is greater to that. Rather, a greater utility of the strategy council should be considered, given that the strategy council and the government departments are all on the same master general platform in any case. So there is an element of efficiency they can cut the setting of structures and systems to deal with procurement matters. I raise the issue of long-term planning as well, increase the stability in the system and the cap. I spoke about the salary wage law, so I don't want to cover that again. A very important and new innovative that requires support from both politicians, the administration, and the public is this new intervention, this new initiative of public procurement review. In essence, it will help to create a greater focus on procurement costs, and one will be able to see what services government is actually buying, what services government departments at all three levels are actually buying. And where those services and contribute to efficiency gains within the system. I think what's important is through the procurement review, there will also be it will also help to identify routine service expenditure that can effectively be eliminated without affecting service delivery. Using efficiency to take it to reduce the burden of infrastructure grants more tightly to the efficiency delivery of capital projects was well raised by I'm sure I've been talked about the investment in that particular area. We think that there's a need to intensify waste, fight against waste and corruption within the public administration, the state administration, and to continue to support audit institutions and apply extremely stringent monitoring and reporting requirements. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayor, for presenting. What seen has really spent a bit of some time to analyze the budget and the medium term budget policy. They've presented the evidence in a few years. They've made some recommendations on areas of support, which I would make our case, you know, that you need to consider as an input. I would say that you may want to consider an early childhood development, because that would be the best area in terms of education. Number two, that may contribute to financing of the National Health Insurance, which is a very critical area of reducing inequality. Third area, I would say, is the question of the development of cities, taking into account that our people live between the city and the rural area. One of the few countries where people could love, you know, accommodation in the city and the rural area.
and number four would be job creation, especially in terms of clothing for infrastructure that are in center. And then number five would be to look at the housing model and ownership. And number six would be a reduction of crime as well as corruption. Those would be the six areas that our students that the committee consider priorities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Chisano and team, for the presentation that you have before the committee. I think at this stage we should allow members of the committee to raise questions or comments on the issues that you have raised. That is Honorable Adolfo. Honorable Aslolo Polo, and we'll take comments as we go on. Honorable Shoto Polo will be the first. Okay. Honorable Polo will be the first. In that order.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks to the team for the presentation. I think it's really assist us and also to summarize kind of without the situation to say the areas of focus maybe that we need to consider when we are dealing with this medium term policy statement. I want to check on Dr. Reddy. In your presentation on the topic framing this presentation or statement, you indicated that you're posing a question around the issue of the cost in education and training skills, and then you said what type of skills do we need, skills learning. It's like I'm not sure whether at the moment as a nation we still does not know which skills do we need as a country. Maybe if you can clarify whether it's something that we need to engage on today as a country so that we can play well, which skills are required, because it was like you were posing a question on this one. And secondly, on page 7, you said a very important statement on the topic focus on the budget. You were all referred to that. You said education and skills development are key to support growth, development and employment. And this is true, really. When we fail on this one, the rest will be a problem. But has the Commission ever done the research in the high institutions of learning whether their courses or disciplines are in line with the things currently required by the country or by the market? This is the question to Dr. Reddy. Coming to Professor Turo, I want to check what is the cause of this low growth of the infrastructure that will stimulate economic growth, such as growth and railways, as you have indicated, that is not moving key infrastructure development that can stimulate economy. What do you think can be done to turn this around? Since you have also indicated in your presentation that private sector employment will be restrained by infrastructure blockage, because it means to say that we still have a challenge if we don't address that particular matter. What will you suggest or advise us? Around the issue of the job creation, as an intervention government, government has to create a short-term to full-time equivalent job as well as skills development. What are challenges that prevent introducing labor-intensive methods in manufacturing? Because in your presentation, you were saying that manufacturing is not labor intensive. But what is it that prevents at the moment introducing labor intensive methods in manufacturing sector? Also, there is a great concern on the country's debt. All of us, and as the economy is not growing, as you have also indicated in your presentation that the target was 2.7, but now we have reduced it to 1.4. It shows that there is a real challenge in the growth of the economy. You have also indicated in your slide that there should be commitment to contain public spending and the budget deficit to limit the growth of borrowing. Because you can see now that the way we are borrowing is going up. It will end up not managing to take the debt the way we are borrowing. If you talk about this commitment to contain the public spending and the budget deficit to limit the growth of borrowing. At the same time, you talk about expanding of the municipal debt market. In other words, trying to encourage the municipality to continue borrowing so that they can fund the infrastructure, I understand. But I want to check to these recommendations that are coming, in particular to expand the municipal debt market or to encourage municipalities to borrow. Has an audit been done on where municipalities are sitting or spending in regard to their debt and whether they are managing to service this debt? I'm saying that because these were already municipalities are borrowing, and now we are saying that we are going to encourage more and expand. Why is the country at the national level, we are sitting at a high debt, which is a concern to us? This recommendation is informed by the fact that the municipalities are still in a good position to continue borrowing so that they can fund the infrastructure development, because we don't need infrastructure development.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your presentations. I have a number of comments, concerns, questions. Madam, you opened by telling us that the economy was not doing well, and we actually agree with you on that. It's obvious from the experience of our policy statement that that is in fact the case. I was a little heartened earlier today when I heard on the news this. While I was worrying about China having a 46% of our GDP as debt, Japan has four times their GDP as debt. At least they have a much higher per capita income, so maybe it's a little more affordable for them, and the effects of this make me feel a little less uncomfortable about our situation. But maybe we've got room to borrow a little more before we get into that kind of position. If I just started with the Ventura, you stated that we need a focus on efficiency. I think this cannot be overemphasized, because although we struggle from the point of view that times are tough, we're in a hard place, and yet every department that comes up says they need more money. If we're going to achieve the objectives in the National Development Bank, we can only do it with more money. With our current growth rate predicted at 1.4%, we're not going to be attracting much foreign investment. We have to turn around our situation first before the investment comes in my opinion. Because people only want to invest in something that's going to produce some kind of return on that investment. At the moment, many countries, I'm sure, show a far better growth potential than we do. We're going to be attracting investment before they come to us. My question then on that particular issue is, can we not find a means of promoting internal investment rather than looking externally? There's a lot of these private business enterprises that sit on huge amounts of cash that they don't put into any kind of infrastructure investment. We need to find ways to do that. I'd appreciate your comments on that, whether it's by way of issuing government bonds or things like this, but maybe we can can't fast track that as a source of additional revenue to fund the budget. I just want to tell you, you made a comment that investment in infrastructure has been slowed down, which is now 20% of GDP. I just want to know how you get to that thing. What do you base it on? It just interested me that you make that statement. I think obviously we need to start growing the economy, in my opinion, and addressing one of the key problems we have in our country, which is unemployment. The more we can grow the economy, the more employment is created. And addressing my colleague's remarks about labour intensity, we can do away with certain machines and replace them with people, rather than the other way around, which then changes the capital gender from people, labour intensity. And maybe we should look at greater avenues of doing that, especially with mundane tools. I mean, it's much easier in a sense to use a team of 10 people rather than a grader, and you create 10 jobs in so doing. And it's not an upfront capital, some of this is producing the greater. And it may be a way of looking at things that might change our situation. As regards to all comments about open municipalities, it's my personal opinion, pay 9% of our budget in municipalities by way of grants is way too low. It's at the municipal level that service delivery in the real thing happens. And municipalities are under-resourced. We're told that they must resource themselves by the collection of record tax, etc., but it doesn't happen. And when it doesn't happen, there's no effective way of fixing the problem. And then so it's right off billions of land in unpaid record taxes. We're not addressing that issue. And we're not going to fix it by just keep on telling them you must collect your revenue. In my opinion, we need to increase the amount that we give to municipalities in order to assist them. There are many municipalities, I've just been through a process myself where or maybe in this context that we heard, that in order to impress who was doing the inspections, maybe the work of the general public or anything, but vehicles and trucks and equipment was moved from site to site, so it looked like everything was well. But the reason that happened is that they don't have vehicles. They don't have the money to buy them. So it was through the landfill site to try and keep the landfill line straight. All these things were moved on site when the inspection was done, and then moved off the site to another site as soon as the inspection happened. But it doesn't solve the problem. It gives them the license. But the real problem is the lack of funds with which to buy the vehicles. I mean, if they had the vehicles, they would buy them. If they had the money, they'd buy the vehicles. I just would like your comments on increasing the allocation of funds to municipalities, rather than pushing the buck back down onto municipalities and say, well, it's your problem, so you must be able to borrow more money. Then cost them more ultimately because of the service charges on those debts row. In the municipality I come from, we regularly send out and borrow money for capital assets, so the purchase of trucks and things like that, because you can't fund them profitably through your cash flow. It doesn't work. You can't go out and buy them for cash or for, so you obtain loans in order to get them and spread the load. The argument is you're spreading load into the next or to the next election, and therefore the next generation that takes your place is not sitting with the debt burden. And it's a real argument, and it's a problem. You wouldn't like to take out a company that's so tied up with debt that you can't move anywhere. All you've got to do is operate in order to pay the debt. I would personally argue against the idea of expanding municipal debt beyond a certain point for that reason. Your comments on the reform infrastructure grants to local governments to scale up their provision of welfare location and affordable social housing and upgrade informal settlements. The present moment's housing is with province and not with municipalities. So the responsibility for production of housing lies with the provincial governments and not with the local municipalities. The local municipalities in effect have to find the land and then convince province to come and put houses up. Very often that's why you have these not very well planned RDP housing developments, because they put up on land that the municipalities didn't really want anyway, so they put them over there. Informal settlements, you may not, up to now, use your MED funding to infrastructure and development in informal settlements, because informal settlements, by definition, are supposed to stop being informal and become formal, and only in that case can you then improve the infrastructure, which puts a huge burden on how do you actually service informal settlements. So I think that the whole idea of informal settlements needs to be addressed rather by converting them into formal settlements. And so the change problem, I know that's a big issue, but it needs to be addressed. You mentioned that the foreign economists told you that we've stored value in a sense. I would argue against that in a way, because we've also created a new mini economy. The trade in RDP houses is quite healthy. People, as soon as they get a title deed to RDP house, they're inclined to sell it because they can get money for it, they can convert and access cash. And that happens quite a lot. Unfortunately, there's still a huge backlog on title deeds for these things, and I think maybe that would be part of the problem, is to address that issue, get the deeds officers on board and find them way fast tracking, getting title deeds to people to whom they owe it. There's also a planning problem here, and I think it comes from, if I can give you an example, in my constituency, because departments don't talk to each other, the department of housing goes out and builds a whole lot of houses, and the department of road goes and puts in roads, and Eskom comes along and puts in high-mast lighting, and you end up with a high-mast light right in the middle of the road, because the two departments didn't speak to each other. And the one department said, well, that's where my plan is, it must go, and so does the other department. And it's just a lack of choice of planning. And I think that needs to be addressed, that we need to be a bit more cohesive. Dr. Reddy, I just want on your slide on the focus of the budget, also related to my colleague's question. We had a presentation last week by the Department of Higher Education and Training. We were told that of the 40 billion men that are distributed since the establishment in 1999, almost 50% have been wrongly allocated because of fraud and corruption and things like that, people coming with false claims and so on. I would ask the HSRC to maybe do some research in that regard as to how much actually has been fraudulently tapped out of the system and what can we do to stop that, because if the money could be correctly allocated, we'd have gone far ahead of where we are now. And I said, well, that's a major concern. So if we are going to allocate 15% of the budget to this section of the education program, might be far better if we knew it was going to get to the right place and achieve the right effect. Well, I fully agree with your skill training aspect, and I raised it there as well. Dr. Lee, I'm afraid I couldn't really understand your graph here at 3.4 South Africa and other countries. Perhaps you just enlighten us a little as to what the point system on that graph means. I'd actually like to understand exactly what was being described to me in that graph. Good to speak. I think that was all I had on that. Professor Mbai, so I just wanted to ask you, we've had an increase in the number of HIV sufferers over the period from 2008 to 2012. I was just interested to know how many of those are economically active, or these people are all economically non-active, because obviously that increase in itself represents a huge burden on the state and an increasing burden up to now. If we could increase the number of antiretroviral patients that we have by doubling it, in effect, because we're currently 2 million or 2.7 million and then add another 2 million onto it. That's going to be a huge burden. And I just wonder if any of these people economically active, because that might help that burden in a way, because perhaps they could pay something towards it. It could be a subsidized thing, not just totally state funded. And I just wanted to ask you, so you made a statement on the graph that said that HIV prevalence among females, where you have the two, the red and the blue. You made a comment that this indication that people are living longer. I don't know how you got that conclusion from that graph. It just looked to me like females have become more sexually active. But that's a little big on my part. Dr. Moorman, just a comment in your presentation on slide 11 in ECD services. You mentioned that at the moment we have 500,000 children who are receiving a state subsidy, and that there are 2 million who are not receiving state support and services. Obviously, if they were, there's another huge burden that could be placed on state and financial terms. I was the champion of early childhood development in the municipality I came from, and I saw for myself the huge difference it makes in the lives of young children when they get direct nutrition. So I'm fully in favour of this. I'm not trying to shoot you down in any way, but I'm just asking, have we addressed this issue in any way? Have we done any research as to what it would actually cost to get every deserving child and needy child into the system? Because it obviously has a huge cost effect, and I don't know whether we've got that in mind when we try and plan how to pay for all this. Once again, perhaps we do need to go out there and become like Japan and for as much as we possibly can. Just applying this, you were speaking about the public sector eligible and this concern of the lower rate increase. My thought on that was perhaps it's not a bad thing, because the more pressure you put on public sector to look outside, perhaps it would be a good thing to attract people to the public sector by offering them competitive salaries. When that salary package becomes very competitive, perhaps they'll go to the outside and see jobs in the private sector rather than the public sector. And this might be a natural way of reducing the public sector we have and stimulating the private sector, because obviously if they have better access to people and more people they could approach, a better pool of resources, if you like, it might just make solve its own problem in a way. So I understand where you're coming from, but I'm just looking at the bigger picture, and I just thought perhaps that would have that effect. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I just also wanted to ask you, you made the point in your slide there, approach of the NTBPS to cable state and public service, and to maintain the real value of public service salaries. I wondered what you had in mind with that statement. I wasn't quite sure how you thought we could achieve that. You say that lower government consumption requires prudent management of public sector wage bills. I agree. Then you say, why maintain the real value of public service salaries? I was just wondering what you meant by that, if you could explain. Thank you, Chair. That's my one.
Thank you, Honourable, my colleague. Honourable, short thank you, colleague.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for this opportunity, but also for your leadership, for having organized people to access that. Because, you know, from the information that we've got, we will know it. We will know exactly what to do. We have been given the light. And also, I want to say thank you for inviting the participants. My mother and her mother put together and they were perfect friends. So I'm very happy for the opportunity to meet my society. I just want to say, Chairperson, I wonder if you can further ask them to do some research on education. You know, higher education, you remember when the Department of Higher Education came to address us, there was this question of, somebody raised a question of, the requirement of actually making sure that there are four people from the FET. So can you speak to the one person, one graduate should be matched with four people who have changed from the SEC body. And I've taken that very seriously. And I wish we can impress upon treasury to make sure that they do assist the department to fund the SEC. the institutional ideology, the university. I don't know. I think we need discussion of that. A very humble discussion of that. Because, I'm not an intellectual. I'm a rural woman. But where I'm sitting, I've got a feeling that we are not together. I don't feel that we have got institutions of higher learning who care for this country. Instead, I feel we have got people in the universities who just want to produce people. Whether these people are going to stay at home or do nothing for the state is not important. That is my feeling in my rural woman's mentality. That is what I'm thinking. And you must understand democracy is outnumbered. There are more rural women than intellectuals in their country. And that is the feeling. And I am the type of politician who is amongst the people all the time. And that is what we're talking about, talking about people. Because you hear people say, writing, you know, that we are quite well, but we don't have a job. You know, that language. In 1984, I started a school. I'm not an intellectual. I started a school. And I train people on computers and accounting. The little that I knew, I thought I could impart into society. People that I taught, today are counselors. Some are mayors, some are members of parliament, some are in the private sector. I'm one rural woman. If all these graduates could have insisted upon their students that they could actually duplicate themselves, I think we would have gone in a I actually once addressed a meeting of that to NSA today. You see, if all of you could just do something outside the classroom, just assist one person, we just know. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's going or what. But we don't seem to be having that type of mentality in the schools of institutions of higher learning. Even now when I am a member of parliament, I am busy building a school just to teach women how to cook properly because health now are a crisis, high blood pressure. I think people are not cooking properly. And that's what I do as a person. That's my hobby. But if this type of hobby could be done by intellectuals who actually have been school and trained, I think this country can go ahead. We are too full of complaining, writing pages and pages every weekend about how bad the government is. And what about ourselves as individuals? What are our contributions to this country that we love? Because the country doesn't belong to government, it belongs to all of us. On the issue of corruption and overspending, I think you have assisted us, this institution has assisted us. That is a wake-up call, not for government, but for members of parliament. What are we paying for? The constitution instructs us to make laws, to communicate with the public, and to do our lives. And when this thing happens, are we trust the people? Maybe we're not trust the people, we did not have the truth and the know-how. So, with working together with yourself, by the wisdom of our chairperson, I think we're going to make sure that people do what they're supposed to do. On health, you know, I was so sad to see that women are contracting HIV so much, and I want to assure my friend here, it is a reading, I want to guarantee that we are not sexually attacked. It is because of the male rape. It is because of that. And I would like maybe to take this discussion with the Department of Correctional Services. For this institution to make a research on these people who get paid for rape, and you find, I read the paper very nice, you find that this person is raped four people, one person, If that person, I always worry, if this person is HIV and AIDS, what does it mean? So HIV is all done on women. It's very painful, Catherine. And I would like to have a research done on the effect of these people's rapes who actually get things, go back, rape another four, come back, because they even call them serial rapists. And that's what a lot of it. And I suspect this is the cause for this unfortunate situation of well-behaving South African women. On social spending, I think the government is doing very well. Between 1988 and 1991, I was very active as a woman leader in the Eastern Transvaal Women's Union in Bushbuckridge. And we used to go to hospitals, we used to go to Transvaal Hospital. We actually made a study on infant mortality. Children were dying before the age of 5. A lot of them. There is one counselor who is a board member of this right. I asked her to monitor this. Children are living now. I used to stay in Roy of last year. It's very rural. And I was used to people coming with a dish to say, my story, can you cook some mini for me? And I remember between 1990 and 1991, where I had to buy every Christmas for four families a bag of meat, because I was a 55 for that cost. Because people didn't have food, and I asked my therapist, can I have something to taste and say, hallelujah, when I know my next door neighbor didn't eat? You know, just out of my Christian belief. So, nowadays, I don't see people going with dishes to the neighbor. People buy their own meat. They suffer from other things they can destroy, but they don't care about it. Not about food. So, I think we must give praise where it is due. Government has saved the lives of many South Africans and the pain and humiliation that people used to go through. I am very happy, my professor, by the way, Professor Shurok was my professor, and I remember you did training us on the apartheid special development. So, I am very happy to see that government is moving towards getting rid of that, the federal loop and of yesteryear. So I think we should monitor that status and make sure it happens. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable. So thank you for that. Honorable Kwarazwa.
Yeah. Thank you, Sir President. Let me express appreciation for this very informative briefing from the SRC. My first question relates to slide 4, where Professor Pastor raised the issue of manufacturing being more capital intensive. The NDP, the National Development Plan, together with the Industrial Policy Action Plan, motivated for that by the Chinese manufacturing. And both leads into the issue of education and skills development as driver of this labor in Chinese. I want to understand, therefore, because this suggested that we need to develop new skills and at the same time retain the workforce that was already employed. Can we take in that regard, and if that is so, what needs to be done? That's my first area of question. The other part leads to that. Is there a need to perhaps do at least a shift from the NDP and the other policy plan so far as better than concerned in the world? The second issue is on the municipalities expanding their debt markets. I think the Honourable Makapa raised this question as well. It's not clear whether we are saying that the municipality should borrow from the domestic financial institution or intensive external financial institution or a combination of both. But the main question is, well, do we think that they will have capacity to service the debt and retain the capital? Remember, they are all in ECOM as well. And so it raises that question, how do we handle that? On education, I'm glad that the presentation demonstrates the need for a real shift from that. Talking about first funding, the huge funding that goes into education, and then the field training, educational training, and it begins to say, but let us begin to understand what are the skills that we need. I think that's a very important point. And then redirect our fine funding towards that direction. Not only at the level of higher education, but also begin to prepare our children from pre-university education, building up to university. This is an extremely important shift. And I'm convinced that if we take that shift, we will change the situation around. But one wants to understand just this area. You know that there has been a focus on giving bursaries to students who are holding to teach in the profession and importantly the health and science leaders. Is that program succeeding? Because if it is succeeding, it must begin to show a marked improvement in our production of medical science results at high school level. But also the challenge that I think we need to look at is the structure of the education system as well, in the provinces in particular. In some places you have a curriculum development section in the province quite different from in-service training of educators, what is sometimes called teacher development. And quite de-linked from a subject like advisor service. Have you had a look into that kind of level of coordination, which might be the reason why there are failures in our primary and secondary school education. And if you have, if there go for restructuring those section found, you know, lying all around in the provincial department, so that you have the course of issue or curriculum development, teacher development, or in-service training, and sometimes call it and subject advisory training. for effective provision of education. The area of skills development, we've already come back to this issue, and members of committee of the committee have asked this question at different times since we had that as a phase to us that over the past 20 years we have de-skilled some sections of our population, particularly in the Africa, followed by the cuts in DC. Those who have fared better are white and Libyan. But so far as Africans are concerned, we've de-skilled the community over the past 20 years. One, how do we change that around, given our education? And secondly, how do we recapture this human resource in which we have lost over the past 5 years, so that we can bring it back to positive social and economic development activities? The other question is on slide 15, you made reference to our failure to deliver working. I would like to understand whether it is the challenge of producing them in the lab community, or is the challenge of actual delivery for both, and what needs to be done for them. And lastly, on health, some years back, in the new democracy, of course, the government came up with a policy for free healthcare services for pregnant mothers and children up to the age of 2. But this issue of maternal death, of newborn babies, some babies not reaching the age of 5, continues. One would like to understand whether we are not doing enough to implement that particular policy. Because if we did, we would have long and minimized this challenge, but it remains a challenge at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Swagaza Eli, Honorable Nyalunga Iwasakani, Honorable Rika Iwasakani, should I know you, okay.
Thank you, Chairman. As my colleagues have already asked some of the questions, and then next to us, I'll only focus on current questions. Slide 5, we talked about the social housing and upgrade in formal settlements. So I just want to check, because there is too many grants in that area and are not well coordinated. Are also not well coordinated. What is your view on this HR access? And what are the best practices from other countries? And then number two, on the one slide 14, you have talked about the planning units in the DHH. Is this not going to be a duplicate of the unit that our unit is, which produces annual performance planning, strategic planning, and other work of the government. And then the third one is on page 9, the link between development and net investing. At a very low level of corporate to other counterparts. What do we need to do in South Africa to break it? And I'm also interested, you talk about the other conflicts that are affecting the donation on the I just want to take that as what is going to do to consider donations on our country.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. My name is Malcolm Seager, a member of the committee. If we have people coming from the rural areas like my colleague on the left, then I think we are in good state. So I think we should get more of them from the rural areas. The presentations, as my colleagues have mentioned previously, they obviously are always, as always, valuable information that we receive. So other than coming for and asking for more money, I think it's some valuable and good input. There's a few issues I would like to comment on, and the first presentation by Professor Tjok, which dealt with the state of the cost of debt. I just would like to know, what is the cost of our debt? We always hear what our figures are, and obviously the reason why I'm asking is because with the downgrading of credit rating and the downgrading of the sovereign debt, etc., the cost of it is affected by those issues. So I just want to know, what are we paying for debt? Not the amount of cost that the percentage. That's the one. And then the other issue is the debt, which is 46% of GDP and growing. And I know we forecast, but those of us and the economists won't agree with me. You know, they are only people that can predict something, and if it doesn't materialize, then they don't get into trouble because, I mean, it's a prediction. But what is, you know, where should we end up? Because we're growing and steady because of the economy. So, you know, it's a difficult question to answer, obviously, because we have no control over the status in an environment because we're now in the global market, and what happens in the rest of the universe is it affects us. So my question is, what is ideal or sustainable? And then we also, the information gives us is a budget deficit of 4% again of GDP. That obviously service the debt and the deficit. This is obviously one of the reasons why debt is growing. So again, what would be like ideally the budget deficit to be? Zero. You know, that obviously it's not practically possible. So that's just my comments as far as that is concerned. And then we have on page 3 of the same presentation, we talk about the tougher approach to managing state entities. Now, you know, what are those? I know indication was mentioned about ESCOM and so forth, but you know, I just get concerned when we don't have specific ideas. We've got objectives, but we don't have a specific solution. And, you know, I'd just like us to indicate what those are, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, by being willfully vague, I'm using the word vague, if we're not specific and we don't give direct instructions, then we are going to continue to get ourselves into trouble with, in my view, and that's, I hope I'm the only one of the 50 million odd people that has a negative view on the future of where we're going, but I believe that we have to get into somebody this trouble and we have to stop sooner rather than later. Private tech investment needs to be encouraged. Is that possible in the current environment? Because we talk about things like maladministration, fraud, corruption, inefficiencies. Now, again, obviously that needs to be dealt with before we get private investment. And when we talk about private investment, my question is, and I probably have an idea what the answer is that are we talking about domestic, talk about foreign investment? Can we just comment on that? That's private investment that we want to encourage. And what are these other incentives? Okay, I've got page 4 in the first presentation as well. We talk about manufacturing that's not labor intensive. We all know that for obvious reasons. But then maybe, should there not be some sort of incentives to industries or sectors that engage in labor intensive manufacturing? you know, that will probably assist in creating jobs. At the end of the day, the autonomy can only grow if your unemployment gets decreased or decreases rather. And then the I might have missed this in the last presentation, but youth wage subsidy is one of these inputs. Is that been successful? Implementation thereof, are we satisfied with the progress to date? And then the same presentation on page 5, we talk about this rural-urban migration. That's where my colleague on the left has come from. She's a rural woman, so she'll know a lot of them are coming to the urban area to make a contribution. We know that they obviously do make a contribution because we've got some good people that come from those areas and they have made a contribution to South Africa. But we keep on talking, and that's my concern, because what are we going to do? And, you know, so this implementation of these good plans, I think they need to be fast-tracked. That's just a comment that I can make. But my question is, are they really being implemented and fast the way they're supposed to be? RDP housing, I just want to just a brief comment on that. We know that to a certain extent it works, obviously, but a lot of waste has been as a result of poor workmanship. So the housing is satisfied on the one hand, but the quality of the housing, so at the end of the day we end up spending more than the initial budget for the RDP housing. Okay. Dr. Reddy's presentation. You mentioned no fee and independent. I'd just like to know why do you focus on that, the no fee and those categories of schools, rather than the actual social environment of the individuals? Because you might find somebody, because of where the area that they live in, they might attend an no fee school. Professor Marcel, unfortunately, I've got nothing to say as far as your presentation. And then the last one, Honorable Chairperson, Professor Simbai, the allocation of health, 11% of total spending. Is there, and maybe we won't have answer today, but is there an analysis of the different categories or the amount that 11% is spent on? Because there obviously areas like education, prevention, treatment, administration, cure, and so forth. So is the allocation of that 11% satisfactory? In other words, is it spent, for example, education, for example, and treatment? That's my solitary concern. That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Quite a lot of questions there. For such stuff, for you and the team. Now I understand why the committee secretary wanted us to start it up last night. But let's see what we can do with the, I mean, the, obviously members want to have lunch before the sitting of the house too, but I'm sure we can push to the quarter past 1:30 to 8 minutes. To cover everything. Of course, one of the things that we have agreed on in the past is that some responses can also be sent in writing so that you don't do a presentation again for another 2 hours. But I just wanted to say that in your priorities, Professor, as a committee, we have already identified, you know, post-schooling is one of the issues that we think needs to be addressed, particularly if you look at investment in vocational training, those aspects. So we agree with the early childhood development, but we think if we can get post-schooling right in the media term, I think we'll do a lot to address the issues of growth in the economy, because we can unleash the kind of skills that we require, particularly from FET colleges, but also universities as well. So I think it's something that as a committee would like to take. We have already had a discussion with the Department of Higher Education, and we are continuing to engage them. I think the issues of FETs need more emphasis. Very important. Low housing model, job creation. Now the last comment from myself, and I think maybe what Professor Turok was talking about earlier about the issues of growth. In the past few years, I can't remember exactly, but I think that during the time, there was a lot of talk about removing funding constraints in order to accelerate growth. If you look at what Agisa was also criticized on that. Maybe we have to look again at this issue because we are all concerned that growth has been revised down to difficult over the next year term. But if we can get the constraints right and begin to invest properly in the economy and enhance investments in the economy, deal with some of the problems that are keeping the private sector away. And as you correctly said, that your question was, will the private sector come on board? What are the kind of issues we need to deal with? Perhaps there may be issues that we take for granted, like red tape, etc. So it's not just issue of corruption, wastage, but maybe issues of red tape. You already said some of the big projects that we always come up with take too long to hit the ground. I agree with you that we need to address some of those issues. If we just sit and say, well, the economy is not going to grow as we want in the next 3 years, it means we are sitting and praying, basically, hoping that our Father will hear our prayers that maybe it should be 5% of GDP. I mean, we have already put a target, the NDP. Economy must grow at least by 5% year on year in that period. We need to do something to get there, rather than sit and pray. But you can comment on that, because I think that's where the crux of the matter is. If we grow the economy, we can create jobs, we can get more revenue, we have more revenue, we can spend it on basic services, we can stop borrowing too much because revenues are better. So we need to really deal with the issue of the economy. We may not deal with it today, I would say, but I'm just saying, I think if the HRC can really pay special attention on what to do about this economy. Professor Sano, you have the floor to your chief.
Okay. Chairperson, I do realize that we don't have enough time since you all have to go somewhere else. So most of the questions that have been asked would prefer that we actually go back and give you a considered response. I think that would be most appropriate. But I'll just pick up just a few things and ask our colleagues. Two people that I really think should actually say something, and that's both Ivankoro as well as Dr. Reb. Just want to say, on the cost of debt, if you look at public debt internationally, South Africa is actually doing much better. If we to say the pound is 226%. You take the United States, it's about 71.8%. South Africa is 45%. So we're not doing too bad. Especially compare us to our colleagues today, if Brazil is 59% and China 52%, but Russia is doing much, much better, 7.9%. So, in terms of debt, I think we're not doing too bad. And also, if you look at in terms of economic growth, if you look at compare South Africa in terms of economic growth with Europe, many of the European states, we're pretty much around the same place. Look at Germany, which is a little bit lower, but around the same, when I say around the same place, it's that between two, let's say 1.5% and 3.5%. So we're not getting too bad. We do hit ourselves too hard in South Africa because of the fact that we've spent a lot from ourselves, given our history, where we come from. I'm just going to have my colleague, who's an economist, who can be able to give you even more information.
Thanks, Professor. Summarize
the questions and consolidated them into eight issues, and I'll deal with them obviously quite briefly because of the time constraints. So the first point I want to make is that I haven't been prescribing very much. I've been trying to summarize the state of the situation. So some of what I said about state entities and so on shouldn't be seen as me, you know, saying what should happen. I'm really describing what the statement says it wants, the government wants to happen. And I've added in some cases a little bit of interpretation, but not very much, really. It's not much. The second point is that growth is a product of many different things. Right? It's a very, very complex thing. The sum indicator, we talk 1.4%, but there are so many different variables that go into it. Right? We shouldn't oversimplify it. There's just one thing. There's no magic bullet. It's a range of things. And I'll hint at some of them in my remarks on these eight points. Let me start with the debt issue, because that's where everybody is at. The cost of our debt is about 10% of our spending. All right? I'm saying not 10%, we're paying 10% interest rate. 10% of our public spending, total public spending, goes just on debt, repays it. A tenth rand out of every 100 rand the government spends goes on paying back the borrowing. Now, that is less than in Japan and in many other countries. But when we talk about Japan, let's not forget that Japan has been stagnant for 20 years. Right? The Japanese economy has been stagnant. It's a very prosperous economy, so there's lots of jobs and high income, but it's not grown. Right? So we need to grow. We're a much poorer economy, and so as comparisons, we need to be careful. This subject is a very, very controversial subject among macroeconomists. I'm not a macroeconomist. All right, so Greece is another bad example. Lots of debt, no growth, massive unemployment. Spain, Ireland would be other examples. So let's be careful about using selectively taking examples. I say it's complicated. There's no ideal that I know about. There is a cost to it, but I think what I make is that use debt counter-cyclical. When you're in a recession, it makes sense to borrow to try and replace, get your economy growing, stimulate it. But over the long term, you probably don't want to have too much debt because it's costly. Yeah? The next point I want to make is about the cause of the slow growth of investment in key infrastructure. It's partly the lack of capital, but also I think some of our procedures are part very complicated, and in particular, many of the hurdles that we have to go through lie in sequence. We have to do one thing and then something else and something else. We can't do them in parallel. I'll give you a clear example around planning and environmental improvements. We have to get the environmental improvement certificate before we get the planning permission. I think that way around or on the other way around. We can't do two simultaneously, right? So for a big project, it takes 2 years to get your environmental approval. And then it's another 2 years for your planning approval. Now many of the things are the same, public consultation. It's the same to go through both of those processes, right? So we need to find a way of aligning them and doing the things in parallel, not one after the other. So the infrastructure bill, that's part of the purpose of the Infrastructure Act, right? It's trying to streamline and rationalize things. The second point was about negative. Again, another really big subject. I think we're in a very mixed picture. So on the one hand, some of the things that we do are in direct government control. The community work program is mentioned, the expanded work program. These are very labor intensive. Government can control it, and that's quite easy. Then we have, on the one hand, the mining industry, which is becoming increasingly mechanized, often in response to the disputes we've had. Right? Mining companies say it's very hard to manage labor, and it's expensive to manage labor. The response is to mechanize. But we do have some labor-intensive manufacturing industries, like the clothing industry, right, suffering a little bit from Chinese competition and the cost of our labor. And then also the issue of skills and the management of people. So there are several variables there which we don't often do ourselves a favor in relation to the way we manage labor and whether we're not genuinely committed, I don't think, to labor-intensive production across government as a whole. A quick one around municipal borrowing and so on. I think it does make a lot of sense for municipalities to borrow for large capital expenditure items, particularly where there would be a revenue stream that can collect some revenue to pay back. It makes a lot of sense. The picture in South Africa is that some municipalities do a lot of borrowing, and others don't do very much at all. I think the Treasury side says that some of those other municipalities, like Cape Town, for example, they don't borrow very much. They've got a lot of capacity to borrow more.
So rather than say to government, give us cash, it's saying borrow locally. And it makes sense if you borrow locally because you're kind of closing the loop of accountability. You know, to your ratepayers. You're spending locally, you're taxing locally, and that improves accountability and efficiency. Two other quick points about housing, and we're trying to transfer the accreditation and approval of housing to municipalities from provinces. We're trying to support that will help to align grants. Transport also being of good. That will help to align the coherence of planning at the municipal level where it makes a lot of sense. So I think we're in the process of doing that. It's got some way to go further. On the mini economy of RDP housing, we should remember the cost that people are getting, the price they're selling their houses for. My understanding is between 10 and 50,000 people sell their RDP houses for. The cost is between 100 and 150,000. Right? So that's where the destruction of value comes from. It's crazy to sell assets with cost of $150 to sell them for $10,000, $20,000. Okay, I'll get there.
Thank you. Thank you. As you observe, after the centers, I have a lot to say, and we would like to talk about down the process. So.
In terms of short response, I'd like to try to pull the thread about the question that you raised about the skills training mechanism. Just to start off to say that in the 2009 administration and the different outcomes that were identified, outcome 5 referred to a skilled and capable workforce for inclusive development, and then outcome 5.1 refers to a development of a skills planning mechanism. And around that time, Dr. Shukran and Minister Jumali also met, and so the Department of Higher Education and Training then asked the HSRC, well, how about to develop the skills planning mechanism? And we all grappled, what is the notion of planning mean? And what is planning mean in, or specifically skills planning in South Africa? And before I pull the thread a little bit more, I just want to refer to one other term. Because it says inclusive development, there's a notion of the developmental status there that, in a way, the state can intervene in terms of the direction of resources, particularly to those that would not be able to come into the system. So as we grapple through this notion of skills planning, and we look at the history, and we know that at a particular time we had manpower planning, and because it was a very closed economy, you could sort of judge what skills were needed, and a lot of the planning referred to the supply. I mean, when you talk about planning or skills planning, we refer to supply, we refer to demand, and we refer to skills shortages. Those are the main terms that we use. And a lot of planning has been done and basically focused on the supply side. How many places have we got at the university, how many people are at headcounts at state college, etc. And of course the people on the other side, on the demand side, are complaining that you're not giving us enough skills and you're not giving us the right type of skills in order for the demands of the economy. And so in our analysis and in working this through, we have to shift focus from supply to actually understand demand much more. And it's not easy to understand demand easily. And we referred to a number of countries, we did international reviews, it was quite comprehensive. And I think after 2 years of trying to understand this, 2 weeks ago we presented to Minister Jumali, that then we started really, so we're feeling a little more confident about the research that we're doing. And so, it is about the understanding of demand, and specifically because of the number of economic growth projects by government, the projects like the strategic infrastructure projects and one of the skills needed, the projects like the 3 kilometer array telescope, because one of the skills that are needed there, the new growth path, and analyzing both the industrial policies. And so in our proposal, we're saying that industrial policies have to be analyzed in order to inform skills. And I think you referred to that, you know, we need to understand the economy first and what is required by the economy.
And at this point, let me even make a disclaimer. I'm not saying that the whole of schooling and education has got to be to create people for the labor market. There's the notion of education for its own sake. Also, to be careful that we don't go to a centralized, you know, a Soviet Union skills, a centralized skills planning. But how do we direct those resources? So, firstly, the analysis of industrial policy and key strategic growth projects of government, and they inform, they use that to inform how education and training should take place. And because of time, I'm just going to give one example. And we talked about the manufacturing sector, and I've talked in the last few years that growth in the manufacturing sector has been stagnant. And yet, and part, oh, by the way, the project that we work on, and which you might see this acronym, is called the Labour Market Intelligence Partnership between the SSRC and GS, LMIT. And part of the research which was undertaken by Professor Harun Borat, in terms of looking at trends for employment and looking also at growth strategies around the world, light manufacturing has been identified as a sector for economic growth. And so how that research is sort of informed deal is that how can you direct your resources towards this area of light manufacturing? So this is a nutshell to say that the skills planning mechanism has come a long way to try to understand, and it's also not a DA project, it's across the state. And we need to have this notion that people talk about coordination, but the notion was so they had a joined up government, and how do we work together on this matter? But I think other things we'll have to do, send you some of the documents.
Thank you very much for my part. I think I've concluded our input today, and we promise to share the information as soon as we have committed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pakistan and the team, for the work that you have done. We will continue to be in touch with the HSRC, knowing the work that we do, we need to be able to advise Parliament properly about where to in terms of what Parliament is doing. Honourable members, we will remain for a short while, that one or two things to tighten up, but you are released. Let's start to go out, and you will hear from us again. Thank you very much. Honourable members, just quickly, when we started to see the agenda says consideration of committee minutes, I hope that you have to see them, because I want us to just adopt them out of the way. For the meeting, we only have an apology from Honourable Concord and Honourable Garvey. They did their permanent apology to check with this is what the problem is. But those are the two we received. Is there any other apology that I missed? Yes. Honourable Manana is not well. Okay, there are 2 sets of minutes, I think. First one was when 13th September, are those minutes 5? Yeah, okay. Role model adoption. Rob Mandrapa, you want to say something?
I want to propose that you address the meaning of the show question of the senior qualifying.
Thank you. Honorable McLellan, you second?
Yes, sir.
So that's done. The last one, the 21st of October. Are they okay? Who moves adoption? Honorable Sir Patola moves. Second. Honorable Swaraza, you can propose that now. We don't have any standing limit now. Okay, we have one upstanding first, okay. Tomorrow we are receiving FFP and budget office where?
Good
old
chamber.
Okay, good old chamber. Nine?
Nine.
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 Nine. Nine. Okay, tomorrow 9 o'clock, Globe Chamber. Thank you very much. I'm going to grab some lunch before we go to the
afternoon.
Not much time left.
Can yes, I have a little bit of time? No, I think we need to